Well, here's to another week and revisiting a subject that we've talked about a number of times with a
Yeah.
little bit of extra added on.
It's important.
We got talking about things because we see it all the time when new clients come in and stuff. We want to talk about what people don't know about criminal law.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even just potential clients or clients who come in. I mean, we get random messages
True, yeah.
asking things, but then asserting things. And so I think it's an important topic for this one, really, what people don't know about the law, or more specifically, criminal law and prosecutions. And we're doing this for an informative basis because we need to have an educated public so they understand what's happening with these cases and why people get charged and what's appropriate by way of trying to defend yourself. It's really important to get educated about this.
So if we start at the beginning, the very beginning is a complaint is made to the police. So the first question is, will the police investigate before laying a charge?
The police came to my door. They told me I was under arrest for sexual assault of my ex-wife. They didn't ask my side of the story. This is a simple case. Like, I didn't do it.
Or if an event is said to have taken place at a public location, and there's a lobby in a hotel, or there's video cameras outside of a bar, that they assume that the police will go and try to obtain video and things like that, which isn't necessarily true. Sometimes it happens, but.
Right. So here's the first thing. One, the police technically are mandated to investigate all crimes. The quality or the depth of that investigation varies. In sexual assault or domestic assault cases, the investigation, most of the time, is fairly limited. It can consist of the statement that the police take from the complainant. Most of the time, the complainant will attend the police station. They'll sit down in a room and be video and audio taped, answering questions to the police officer and giving their evidence. That's a statement. The statement can simply be on audio as well. Or it could be on a body cam, which is much more problematic, but can occur. That can be the end of the investigation.
And that's because a person's statement, if given the statement is repeated at trial, either through playing the video if it was a younger person or by testifying to the same effect, if what they have to say would amount to a criminal offense, if it were true, then that's sufficient enough to lay a charge.
So, in other words, the police just have to have what we've called reasonable and probable grounds to lay a charge. So they don't challenge the complainant. If a complainant wants to provide messages, the police won't necessarily take the phone and look at it or even do anything with the phone. They may ask the complainant for screenshots and to email it in or to provide it during the statement. Nothing more. I've railed about this before. And podcasts to say the police, what's the problem with asking to take the phone and extract from it? That will never happen. Okay. The police will then ask if there's any injuries. If the complainant happened to go to a hospital or to a physician for injuries, they will obtain the medical records. If it's a sexual assault, the complainant goes to hospital, has a sexual assault evidence kit done, they will obtain that. There will be photographs done of injuries. If the complainant has spoken to a friend or other person disclosing the allegation, that person may be interviewed or other persons about the disclosure, what the demeanor was of the complainant while giving that disclosure. If there's some surveillance, let's say a sexual assault occurs in a condo building. There's cameras in the parking lot, there's cameras in the lobby. The police may go out to try, depending upon what's involved in the case, may go out to obtain surveillance, the video digital footage, but they don't have to, and often they don't.
And so you mentioned messages, and that's kind of interesting because it's been made very clear that there's a big difference between messages in a complainant's possession and messages in an accused possession.
Yeah, elaborate.
That anything that a complainant offers in terms of messages, and they could be partial messages, this is whatever that person wants to provide to the police, that
doesn't have to be a complete threat,
into evidence, and the Crown could use those. If, say, they did do something where they edited messages, and the accused wants to put in the full record of the messages, they have to bring an application to get permission to use the full messages.
But not for the prosecution.
But the prosecutor doesn't have to do that. So so there's a difference in, they are keen on messages, but we've also had cases where they just read messages from their phone during the interview.
Into, and the messages, into the video statement.
Into the video statement, and the messages were never actually obtained.
Correct.
So, you know, it can be helpful, but this is one thing that people don't understand too, is they think, oh, well, this person's accusing me. I have messages that say, you know, it can be a variety of things, that show that that they continued going out with me and they wanted to go on another date the next week. Therefore, everybody will see that I'm innocent. Or I have messages from, you know, earlier on that day where, you know, the complainant's really excited to see me and sending sexualized messages. Well, those aren't necessarily helpful either. And it's really difficult for people to understand why it's complicated. But they also seem to have this idea that, oh, well, if I just show these messages, then everybody will see, right? And
right.
It's not that simple.
No, it doesn't work that way. Let me circle back, though, for 1 second. That's pretty much what we see by way of police investigations, what we've described. There's usually nothing more. What if, first of all, and an accused, the police often will not ask for a statement, and they always give the caution and rights to counsel, which means you have a right to speak to a lawyer. You don't have to speak to the police. If you do, anything you say can and will be used against you. And a lot of the time the police say, don't talk to me, speak to your lawyer once you get a lawyer. Commonly, people will call and complain they didn't want my side of the story. That's great. You should send a donation to that officer's division. Yeah. Because they're giving you, you know, a benefit there. People do not know what their defense will be 9 out of 10 times when they are arrested. Giving the statement you cannot take back, that statement will be used as evidence. What you have said,
and can be given in a state of stress and
right.
panic.
So you're definitely in panic if you're being arrested. Your whole life is turning upside down at that point. That's not the time to try and give a statement. Rare circumstances, a person can give an organized, comprehensive statement and provide evidence. And that doesn't happen often, but it can happen. But the advice is don't give a statement. What you haven't said, you can always say. But let's just go to an example. A person is giving a statement to police and says, look, I have 5 people you need to speak to. These people were there when she says that I beat her up. We were at, you know, a dinner party. You can speak to Tom, Jerry, and Picard, and Kylo Ren, and here's their phone numbers, okay? What will the police do with that?
We did have a case where they took the people's names and actually got the correct spelling and everything and didn't contact a single person.
And he actually said in one of the interviews, you can give us this information, but we're not going to interview them.
Yeah.
Because the police don't have to do a defense investigation.
Yeah. They said this is going to basically save it and tell the judge, because this is going to, you're going to be charged and you're going to go to trial. You know, you can present your witnesses there.
Pause. Okay, so that's the truth. That's reality. Okay, not being critical, but they don't have to investigate.
That said, we did talk about a recent case where the complainant ended up charged and pled guilty to making a false report because the police in that case did, you know.
Well, after like a third
but
breach
after a third
charge.
Arrest and yeah. And because the person had a witness that they actually did speak to, but
so now yeah. I had one case where the police were trying to find the witness, and the witness wouldn't give a statement, but they were trying to get a statement from the witness. I believe they thought it would confirm the complainant's evidence. What it turned out to be, it absolutely unequivocally contradicted the complainant's evidence, because we got a private investigator, and well, because of that, the complainant wound up going to speak to the police, and it undermined the Crown's case. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there have been instances where police have actually interviewed other people and it provided additional evidence, which has been helpful. For example, in cases regarding capacity to consent, where there are a number of people together at an event or a party and somebody's drunk, they'll want to speak to other people who are at the party to give evidence as to the capacity of that individual. Were they stumbling? Were they falling? Were they sleeping? Were they throwing up? And sometimes when the police are interviewing a number of people, some helpful evidence comes out from that, but not often.
Yeah, and that gets into another area of things that people don't know. There's a massive misunderstanding, in part because of, you know, things that have been published, in magazines and in newspapers and such about the role of alcohol involved in, you know, and how it's involved in sexual assault. And quite often it is involved, but there's a huge misunderstanding about at what point somebody cannot consent to sexual activity.
Talk about that.
So, and it's a big thing at universities too. And I think mostly they're trying to just create more responsible behavior.
Yes.
But it's led a lot of people to believe that as soon as a person has one or two drinks, that now I'm drunk, and therefore if they end up, you know, consenting to something, well, it doesn't matter because I was too drunk.
You're talking about a person with a vagina.
Right. As the Supreme Court would say. It usually is a situation where, the female is saying that they were too drunk to consent. The guy was drinking too.
But the guy says, but I was drunk too.
And that's the other thing too, is that people say,
talk about that. I was drunk as well. Is that not a defense?
So people think that it doesn't matter if the other person was drunk, if they were drunk as well. And the reality is like, it can get really complicated because then it undermines the reliability of what you might testify to. If you want to make a big deal and overplay how intoxicated you are, then, well, how are you going to accurately testify as to what you perceived was going on?
Imagine this horrifying scenario. Person's arrested for sexual assault for somebody they know. They were at a party. They were all drinking. The complainant says she was sexually assaulted by X. X is arrested. X is brought into an interview room. X is saying, I don't remember sexually assaulting her. I don't know. I was completely drunk. I can't remember anything.
I had a blackout.
I was drunk too. I can't remember. I was drunk too. Mm-hmm. End of statement.
This is terrible. Because then you're stuck with that statement.
I'm calm at the moment. Talk about it.
Then you're stuck with that statement, and then the person, in a sexual assault case, you pretty much always have to testify. But if you've already, told police that you're so drunk that you don't remember anything, then how in the world are you going to testify as to what really happened?
It's over.
There's no he said and the she said he said. There's no he said.
You can't take the stand and say, okay, now 2 years later, it all came back to me through hypnosis. Like, no.
My body remembered.
Yeah. It's not going to happen. You're toast.
Yeah.
Because in a capacity case like that, the accused is going to have to testify and say, well, hold on. She was drinking. I was drinking. But I remember everything. I think we had like 3 or 4 tequilas. Other people were around. And then we went out for a walk. We wound up at my apartment. We didn't have any further to drink. And you start to describe the unfolding of events. If you can't give these details, and
at least the core details.
The core details and about the level of participation of the other individual, about them knowing what they were engaging in, you don't have a defense to a capacity argument if the complainant's pretty clear about being highly intoxicated and there's some evidence to that. Mm-hmm. If you eliminate yourself as a reliable witness because of your level of intoxication, there is no he said, as you said.
Yeah.
So just imagine that nightmare scenario. So when people suggest, well, I was drunk too, that's not a defense. That, in fact, can get you into trouble and get you into a conviction.
Absolutely.
Can we go back to this for a second? Because it's too much of an important point.
Okay.
When somebody says messages showing continued contact, I have messages that show that we continued to contact. We went out on further dates. You know, she was having a good time with me.
She sent me a Valentine's Day card.
If anybody reads these messages, they'll know I'm not guilty. This is easy. I'm going to win because I didn't do it. Go ahead. The ball's in your court.
It's never easy. But of course, this is a myth that we've mentioned before. It's considered to be a myth and stereotype that a real victim would not continue a relationship. Well, sometimes people just kind of, try and suck it up and just think, okay, that's not the way they usually are, so I'll just give them another chance. And you know, there's a lot of reasons that people stay in really bad relationships quite often. So it tells us absolutely nothing about what happened on a particular date just because the person remained in the relationship, or even sought out another date afterwards. Because like some people will say, well, I just wanted to find out, is this really, like, try and make sense of what happened.
So now again, that somebody will say common sense will suggest that if somebody was really abused, they wouldn't continue to see me, go out, tell me that they love me, send me Valentine's Day cards, go on a trip to NASA or to Barbados with me. Yeah, I get NASA? That. You're right. NASA. I like NASA. You got to go really January, February, because it's really unpredictable. It's like Florida. It's very unpredictable at winter break.
Okay.
So messages are extremely important and robust foundations of evidence for the defense, but they must be used properly. They need to be in chronology. We need to assess them, and we need to ground them in the evidence of the complainant and the facts of the case. So there has to be a defense narrative which is built, and we have to ground this in the evidence. Otherwise, the mere fact that the messages exist, that people continued in contact and saw each other, in and of itself will not exonerate somebody. It will not necessarily amount to a defense, and it certainly won't deter the police from laying a charge.
And this is why we say, like, you need to really see the statement of the complainant before you can understand what your defense is or isn't, because it does matter that contact continued if the complainant says that they never spoke to the person again.
That's right.
Or that they always hated them and they tried to avoid contact whenever they had to be in their presence. Then it can make the messages relevant, because then, you know, we say grounding it in, you know, in the evidence, we're grounding it to a statement that contradicts what was said.
Yeah, and so let's give another really example. It's kind of a turn on a few of the cases we had. So some couples will message each other all the time, and they'll have arguments over messages. So a complainant can say, hypothetically in their statement, the fact that he sexually assaulted me lingered as a problem in our relationship. I tried many times to talk to him about it. We had arguments about it. And he just wouldn't accept responsibility for what he did. And he didn't understand how he hurt me. Yet the accused gives us thousands of messages over the course of this year relationship. They are talking incessantly on messages. And they are clearly arguing in these messages. Like, there's heated battles in these messages. And it all has to do about other things, behavior, but not a single mention in any way, innuendo, reference, anything to about that night, about being hurt that way, nothing. So that's where you have to be very strategic and very careful in cross-examination. You can ground the relevance of the messages in the nature of the complainant, who had no difficulty telling the accused that he was a dick for not shopping and forgetting the milk, that he was a dick for not, you know, closing the garage door. He was a dick for not remembering their anniversary. He was a dick for speaking poorly to her sister. Mm-hmm. Yet,
all these minor things
you go off on him about, and you're mad at him because it doesn't respect your feelings. But not once did you say, "F-ing asshole," you know, you still haven't apologized to me for what you did that night. So you ground it in the evidence. You have to build up the cross-examination in a way that you're getting down to the nature of the complainant and what she will argue about, and berate the individual about. Yet there's no mention about something that was really serious and allegedly you spoke about on 17 million occasions, but you never once mentioned in your 3,000 messages. That's how you ground it. So the messages, yes, they're relevant, but they will not automatically exonerate anybody, and they have to be carefully used.
And we've been asked as well to, you know, talk a little bit about cross-examination, and this is a good example. When you're cross-examining somebody, you have to lay the foundation for,
yes,
for the impeachment evidence first. So you have to first get it out in, you know, in court. Are you telling us that that you spoke about this, you know, all the time with this individual? Or are you telling us you never spoke to this individual? You have to get that evidence out first and then say, okay, well, let me take you to your statement or let me take you to your messages. So
excellent.
That's called laying the foundation.
There's something you wrote down here in preparation for this podcast I think is really important. Messages showing advanced sexual discussions will vindicate me.
There was a fairly high profile case actually where somebody had sent a message just like an hour before they met up that night saying, why don't you come out and we'll have hot sex?
Yep.
Right. So that was a text message that played a role in a case. And it was only important because the person denied actually really being interested in seeing the person that night.
So let's pause for 1 second. So messages showing advanced sexual discussions will vindicate me. No, they will not. Advanced consent does not amount to consent at the time of sexual activity. A person can give advanced consent. It means nothing. It means nothing in law. Zero, zilch, nothing. It's a ball, not a strike.
Mm-hmm. There was a very big decision on precisely that issue called JA.
I like to use sports analogies once in a while.
from the Supreme Court, and you know, I think we've mentioned this case before because it is relevant to a lot of, you know, because there's a lot of issues around advanced consent ideas. But in that particular case, the person had agreed to be choked unconscious and then a sexual act was performed.
Good point, yeah.
And so the Supreme Court, in that complainant actually didn't want it to go further. She just said, I was just mad at the time. But they went, no, we want to decide this. Yeah. Can you consent when you're unconscious? And so, and they said no, because you're incapable of withdrawing consent if there's something happening that you know. So basically you can't, you know, engage in a sexual act upon somebody who's unconscious.
And not only was that stated in a case, it was codified in the amendments to the criminal code so that a person who is unconscious cannot consent.
And in that case, it wasn't just being unconscious. It was that the person had said in advance that you can do this stuff to me.
Right. And which we spoke about this before. People who engage in the BDSM lifestyle need to realize how they can be at risk. So if there's something about rendering the partner who wants to be unconscious for some period of time during the course of sexual contact in the realm of BDS play, you're walking right into a criminal offense.
Or they give advanced consent for specific acts, which they then decide that they're not enjoying. And then the person says, well, you know, but we negotiated this.
Right.
You know, so, you know, that is a problem for them, that there's quite a bit of, like, they'll sometimes, you know, I don't think it's as common as they, you know, as people think, but they'll fill out contracts to say, I'm okay with this. This is kind of edgy for me.
A lot of the time they'll have
and
contracts.
And it's a massive, like a document full of advanced consent. And they don't realize that you can't give advanced consent.
And you can't consent to bodily harm.
Correct. Yeah.
Just to go back for one session. On this messages showing advanced sexual discussions. So again, it won't vindicate because consent at the time is what's relevant. However, what you were saying importantly was if you ground the question and the message in the evidence, it may become relevant. So if you get the complainant saying, or the complainant is saying, I wasn't interested in any sex. Mm-hmm. With him at all.
Yeah, we were just friends.
We were just friends and we were going out for drinks. We were hanging out, but I wasn't doing that. And the person doesn't recall the messaging that they had. Now, the messaging is relevant to rebut the narrative of the complainant distancing herself from any sexual interest in the accused.
Mm-hmm. We had an interesting
highly relevant
panel discussion on this issue as well, too, where, you know, the person that we were debating was saying, well, how is it fair to a complainant to just ambush them with messages? And, you know, and I said, well, the reality is the messages were sent. It's not our fault that they don't remember them. But it gives us a real-time account for, like, maybe they forgot what they were feeling at the time, but these messages actually, you know, is not so much an ambush. It's like they sent them. They should recall it.
Yeah, and it's worse than that. So this is really important. So this goes back to Bill C-51. And we do lament the fact that if there are authentic messages between the parties, there should be no need, frankly, to vet them unless it's really a 276 issue under the old regime. And if it has to do with the subject matter of the offense, it should be admissible. But here's the thing. The change in this legislation has slightly altered the framework. Most of the time, we can establish that if there's a message about wanting some sort of sexual activity in the close time leading up to the sexual act, we're able to get it admitted as relevant to rebut the narrative. On occasion recently, a judge has said, I don't see how it's relevant at all. And it's within the week of which these two people were together, where the complainant is essentially saying she was a slave to give sex and didn't want sex. And there's a message about essentially sex play. And that's not initiated by the complainant. It's excluded by the court now because they said, we don't see how it's relevant. And that because it's not relevant to the actual date of the offense.
But there's no precise,
there's no precise date on the sex assault.
On the allegations. Yeah.
So this is the mischief that this new legislation can play once in a while. It can give some latitude to a court to decide it's not relevant because it doesn't go directly to the actual offense, which is wrong in law.
And, you know, there is a potential to reopen an application once the testimony comes out at trial. And then you can say, look, you know, this thing was said. Because there was an issue there too, where there's certain comments that we see in a statement, and then the prosecutor will say, well, I'm not gonna, you know, it's not relevant, so I'm not gonna lead the evidence. So something, you know, you might try and get permission for it, and then it turns out it actually doesn't matter because, you know, that's not gonna be part of the
Right.
case. Yeah. I mean, maybe a little complicated,
Charges
but.
can be withdrawn using influence.
So, a lot of people, I think, they watch too many movies and or TV shows, but they sometimes have this idea that you just get the right lawyer with the right influence, and then they can just
I
go work
know the
things
Crown
out.
attorneys in Newmarket. I know them. I know the Crown attorneys in Newmarket.
So that's you know, that's a misunderstanding about the way things work, especially with sexual assault charges. You know, there is a mandate to prosecute more of these cases, and it's, you know, it's extremely difficult for a prosecutor to justify withdrawing charges because they're having their cases reviewed by the media
Any
and.
type of withdrawal of a sexual assault case, if you're dealing with a very senior counsel, Crown counsel, who could be, let's say, a deputy Crown, that person may, in and of themselves, have the discretion, or certain experienced Crown counsel will have the discretion. It won't be based upon influence. It'll be based upon facts. Facts that you can provide that will prove in a demonstrative way that the complainant is likely not telling the truth. And then you can move a Crown attorney to the right direction. Often the Crown attorney will have to seek approval of a deputy or a team of Crown attorneys on the sexual assault unit. So it is not an easy process. After 31 years of litigating in Ontario, I know a lot of Crown attorneys. I'm very friendly with a lot of Crown attorneys. They know us as a senior, serious law firm. I don't expect a Crown attorney to do something just simply because they know us. I don't expect a Crown attorney to put their job in jeopardy. I do expect them to judiciously review a case for reasonable prospect of conviction. But what we do is we put forward evidence in a very strategic, organized way with a memo and a chart explaining why it should be withdrawn. So influence itself means nothing. And people should realize the only way to work a case is to build a defense narrative. And if you have good evidence to establish that there may be fabrication, that's something you can work with.
With these types of charges, though, you should always be prepared to go to trial.
You know, I'm not guilty because she was dressed up with makeup and she was wearing a, you
Really
know, a
short
really sexy outfit and a short
skirt.
skirt.
The top cut
I'm
down
not
to here.
guilty.
I know. And sometimes we get that as feedback, and just like we'll say to people, well, let us know what your thoughts are once you are able to review the statement. And all we get back is, well, she's lying. She's lying. And that's really the most comment we get. It was like, this is ridiculous. This is all a lie. It's like, okay, well, that's not going to work. You can't just go into trial and say
Yeah,
she's
and
lying.
look, let's be fair. People are traumatized. Our clients are traumatized. Their life is upside down. We have always said being charged with these offenses is a life-altering event. We're compassionate, we're caring, we work with them, we provide support. We understand that. But in working with whoever you have as your lawyer, just saying whatever they're wearing, that is a complete myth-based reasoning. That's not appropriate. That's not a license to have sex with anybody. That's not helpful. We understand that the position of a client will be that they're lying. We get that. We need meat on the bones.
There's something else that I forgot because I was looking at the next thing after, but she's lying. But what they're wearing, you know, there is an interesting point to make there is that, you know, there's some people that say, oh, every single court case, you know, the female complainant's always asked what she was wearing. And I said, well, usually because we have to figure out how the clothing came off.
Right.
That's really the only reason that clothing gets talked about at every trial is like, well, what were you wearing? Because we want to know how did that clothing get
The
reversed.
mechanics of it. We you know, there's a case that we're arguing now where the complainant is describing a very vicious rape where she's pinned against the bed with like a sweat top on and a shirt and bra and everything. And the mechanics of it is impossible of what she's describing, which undermines her credibility and reliability, and frankly supports what her client is saying as to how they became undressed. That's when it's relevant. But what we commonly do with clients to try and help them through the process is give them the statement in writing. It's transcribed. The clients can come in and view the video as well. We can't give them the video. And then we want them to provide us with some sort of a chronology, a timeline, an outline, and their rebuttal as to what it is. And then we sit down and we review everything together and try and work with their emotions and work with what they're saying to develop what we need to defend the case. But it's really important so that if you're working with your lawyer, whoever it is, just simply saying they're not telling the truth isn't helpful. The lawyer needs guidance.
Mm-hmm. And the importance
talk
of,
about it.
The importance of reviewing the statement first is because it can focus you, especially when you're dealing with a case that has a relationship that went on for a lengthy amount of time. So until you see the statement, I mean, you could end up, your mind could be, you could be saving every single message from everywhere. Whereas when you read the statement, you go, okay, we can focus in on this time period. Or there's another statement in here that I can show that this particular thing is not true. Otherwise, just like, it's like trying to find a needle in a haystack. All you've got is this big haystack. If you can make it so that you can focus on precisely what it is you're looking for.
It's an important point. The reality is the client is as much a part of the defense team as the lawyers involved in the file, or Diana is an expert in our cases as well. We're all part of the team. We got to work together. We work through the emotions. We try and provide the support, and we try and draw out from our clients as much information as possible to construct the defense. And that includes helping us with giving us what is generally relevant. We err on the side of giving us more so that we don't put the client in the position of it. But it's important when people say, potential clients saying, well, they're just lying. We need more than that. So these are important things to understand, when somebody's coming to the police. Are we over time? Like, can we just shift for one more second? What's unique about, from a prosecution standpoint, strategies in cross-examining an accused in either a sexual assault or a domestic assault case? Is there anything unique about the strategy of a Crown attorney in trying to undermine an accused evidence, which could lead to maybe, a wrongful conviction?
Well, when we do closing submissions, which in most of our cases we do written submissions, pretty much all of them now, that's a large component of putting together really good quality submissions, is to really see where the prosecutor is going with a certain line of questioning, to understand what their strategy is going to be in terms of trying to prove guilt. And so there's certain things that people need to understand. You can take a message that in your own testimony, you can say, oh, this is what that message meant, and this is why I wrote it. But a prosecutor could take that same message and twist it around and make it into something totally different. So you always need to think about not just, because we're always biased to our own opinion about, and our own memories and so on. It's always helpful to be able to try and step outside of that little bubble and think about how it could be used in a different way.
So I just want to give one example. I think we'll do a few of these, but in cases that particularly arise out of a breakup of a relationship. So it could be a bitter divorce, high conflict divorce. It could be the end of a 2 or 3 year relationship. There's bitterness. There's sometimes an instinct for a complainant or an accused to denigrate or vilify the other person endlessly in their testimony. It's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault. They did this wrong. They're the one who does this. They're the one who does that. For a skilled defense lawyer cross-examining a complainant or a skilled prosecutor cross-examining accused, you can seize on that negativity and show that the person is unreasonable in their evidence.
Or their memories have been infected by their emotions. Yeah.
And that's how they've come to view that.
How many times have you said to somebody, it was like, do you have anything nice to say about them?
yeah, like, I can't tell you how many cases. I think the first time you saw that, it was funny because this ex-wife who really hated her ex-husband who was charged, like, hated him, just went on and on and on. I mean, even the Crown was like, when's it going to stop?
He put the toilet paper on with the thing coming out the back instead of the front.
The Crown, I think, sat down, had a smoke, ate a slice of pizza, then got back up to ask the next question. It took that long. And so by the end of it, I got up. I think it was my first question. I said, Ms. Such and Such, do you have anything nice actually to say about your ex-husband? And she stopped.
She couldn't think of
anything. No, but she smiled. It was hilarious. She actually stopped and she stared at me and she goes, no. And of course that could cut both ways. She could be telling the truth. But I've used that so many times because that it's never that way.
Yeah.
Right? And so, as a person who's testifying, Crowns will try and seize upon not yielding obvious facts.
Yeah.
Being overly denigrating towards the complainant. Those are two really important areas.
A really big one, too, is just saying, you know, like, I was never alone with this person. The never statements.
That's a case of opportunity. You know, you have to be careful about certain absolutes and about, you know, they're, and for example, in a sexual assault case, you know, so you were attracted to her. You were interested in having sex with her. Absolutely not. I wasn't attracted to her at all.
Right.
And it's like, okay, so why
we did have that happen one time though, where the person I think was confused because they were thinking, "Now, am I attracted to her now?" You know,
no, but there can be misunderstandings. But then they came up to a right answer, which was, "Well, at the time that we first met, I wasn't, but then over time, as we got to know each other, an attraction built." Or the proper thing to say is, "No, I was very attracted to the person." Right? You know, don't. Sometimes the instinct when a Crown attorney asks that question, you have, like, we spend time trying to get the clients to understand the parameters and the details of their evidence. But you got to risk the temptation to try and deny what is the obvious. Yeah. Yes, you were attracted to them. Yes, you were thinking about sex. That's not wrong. As one judge said to us, it's not a crime to seduce somebody.
Right, yeah.
Right?
I know.
So there's a lot of this we can talk about. It's the reasonableness of the evidence that you give that's important. The reasonableness, the balance. You know, I always say understatement wins the day, and that's what's important.
Well, on a final note, another thing that people don't understand is that in terms of communicating consent, that actions are the equivalent of words in some cases. It doesn't have to just be words, yes, enthusiastic consent,
right,
or verbal consent, that actions can equate to words too. And on that note, if you like our podcast, take the action to subscribe, comment, share, like the video, and tell all your friends.
Good night. Thank you for your viewership, your support, and sending in all the great questions that you do. Good night.